My name is Dale Marshall. I'm with the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. I'm going to start by, first of all, thanking Viperg for inviting me here. I always like talking to people, and I always like being a part of a panel because I hear other points of view sometimes. Definitely. I'm going to start by just saying a few words about the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, and then I'll go to what I'm here to talk about, which is the economics of offshore oil. The CCPA is we're a public policy research institute, so that's a bit of a mouthful. We're a nonprofit organization that does research into public policy issues. My particular area of interest is resource and environmental issues. We have people who do research on globalization and free trade. We have people who do research on poverty and inequality. And we have people who do research on things like the value of public services, like healthcare and education. We're a membership-based organization, so 2/3 of our funding comes from people like you who join because they believe in what we do. Our mantra is, public policy is about choices. Sexy, eh? You can't expect much from a place that calls itself a public policy research institute. Most times you use those four words together, people's eyes just glaze over. They don't really know what the hell you're talking about. But public policy is about choices is basically a reaction to the Tina syndrome. There is no alternative. And as Guy just demonstrated, there are thousands of alternatives. There always are. With every single policy decision, there are always many alternatives. There are alternatives to dictating your foreign policy based on a flow of oil from the Middle East. There are alternatives to setting your domestic energy policy based on continuing to wreak havoc on the climate by focusing on fossil fuels. There are alternatives to resource policies that continue to marginalize First Nations people. And the current government is showing us exactly how to exactly use the Tina syndrome, right? There is no alternative to huge tax cuts that mainly benefit corporations and the wealthy. And then, of course, now that we don't have as much money, there is no alternative to cutting public services. And, oh yeah, we might sell off some public resources while we're at it to pay for it. There is no alternative to doing this. So I would encourage all of you to take a look at the material I have out front, because there's some stuff there on the tax cuts and who benefited and the service cuts and what they mean. And you can also check out our website, which is policyalternatives.ca. Okay, let me move on and talk to you about what I'm here to talk about, which is offshore oil. Last fall, I was listening to the debate over offshore oil, and it seemed like it was a debate over economics versus the environment, right? So people were saying, we need offshore oil because we need economic development, we need offshore oil because we need jobs, and clearly there were some environmental concerns that were being addressed by people in a pretty clear way, that there were clear environmental risks associated with this. And what I decided, I said, well, let's take a look if there's really an economic imperative to take a look at offshore oil and to lift the moratorium. And so what I did is I took a look at an existing offshore oil project, which is the Hibernia project. It was the one that was the furthest along in Canada. I figured, you know, there'll be some good data on that and figure it out. And so I won't keep you in suspense. The conclusion is offshore oil makes no sense economically. It makes no sense in terms of creating jobs. It makes no sense in terms of returning money to the public coffers. Hibernia was an incredibly costly project, $5.2 billion just to build the structure itself. And of course what happened is that at some point or other, the Hibernia Management Development Corporation, this consortium that was putting together Hibernia, decided that it wasn't profitable, and they went to the federal government, cap in hand, saying, you know what, price of oil is really low right now, and this is not a viable project unless you give us $1 billion in grants and $1.66 billion in loan guarantees. And of course, the federal government said, sure. So the head of the corporation came out and said, you know what, I thought that was the end of Hibernia, but by Jove, they went for it in elation. So I've got actually my only overhead. this is the summary of all the money, the public money that went into Hibernia. Grants, the equity position. 1992, Gulf looked at the economics and said, you know what, this is ridiculous. We're taking our money and we're going home. And of course, what the federal government did at that point is said, oh, we'll step in and we'll take over an 8.5% interest in Hibernia. And so that was another $1 billion. And extended a loan guarantee to an American company to buy up another 6.5% interest. The royalties that come out of Hibernia, they're completely tied to the price of oil. So the federal royalties is about 10% of net revenue, but of course, if the price of oil drops below a certain amount, the royalties that go back to the feds goes down by the same amount. And same with the province. You have an increasing percentage of revenues that go to the province, and there are all kinds of ways of, you know, you can deduct transportation costs, you can deduct when the price of oil drops. And so when you look at those two royalties together, at the very most, it would be just over $2 billion return to the governments, to the two levels of government. So you take a look at all of that, and you say, well, why would you do it in terms of, if your only interest was getting money into the public coffers, why would you do it? And Wade Locke, who's a well-known economist out at Memorial University, he's actually a proponent of offshore oil, and he called it a marginal project. He said it was unviable without government assistance. And essentially, the economic, when you tie all of the royalties to the price of oil, essentially what you're doing is you're taking all the economic risks and you're putting it all on the government. Of course, the oil companies won't invest $5 billion unless they know they're going to get a return. And they will. And it's because the government steps in every time the oil companies get in trouble. Taking a look from a jobs perspective, there's a couple of phases of offshore oil. The first is exploration. And for the most part, exploration crews are brought in from outside of wherever it is that they're exploring. These are globalized industries. The oil companies hire their contractors. The contractors hire their workers. They come in from wherever it is they were before, and they do the exploration. So locally, what you end up with is a few people like servicing boats and servicing helicopters. Like that's essentially what the job spin-off is for with respect to exploration. In terms of the construction phase, Hibernia actually created 5,000 jobs for 5 years. It was all constructing the actual platform itself. Which, you know, people could say that's pretty good. I mean, it's short term, it's, you know, only 5 years, but 5,000 jobs is nothing to sneeze at, and, you know, certainly the North Coast would love to get that kind of job creation. But the Bull Arm facility, which is highly subsidized to be built, is now empty. There are still offshore oil projects being developed on the East Coast, but nobody's building it at Bull Arm. They'll build it wherever it's cheapest and wherever there's already expertise, and that's not Newfoundland and it's not BC. So what's remaining with Hibernia is about 800 jobs. Two-thirds of them are offshore, either on the rig or in the tanker that shuttles between the rig and the shore. Again, a BC community might say, well, you know, 800 jobs, it's not bad. In fact, that's exactly the number of jobs that are at the Skeena Cellulose pulp mill. That, you know, people who are sitting at home waiting to see if someone's going to buy that. But how is BC different? There's really important differences between Newfoundland experience and what we can see in BC. The first has to do with jurisdiction. The Supreme Court in 1984 ruled that the federal government had exclusive jurisdiction over offshore oil reserves. But what the federal government said is, well, you know what? We can let Newfoundland in on some of the money because we can just claw that back in transfer payments. Right? Right now we have these equalization programs where certain money goes to Newfoundland because it's a have-not province. But every 97%, it was calculated, 97% of the royalties that went to Newfoundland were clawed back by the province. So it remains to be seen if that would happen in BC, which is a have province. Would the feds put up this much money? Would they be as enthusiastic about offshore oil to a province where they won't get the same return, where there isn't a you know, as great a need for economic development? BC is also a lot more complicated because of other jurisdictional issues, namely First Nations people. There are 4 First Nations people that are claiming territorial rights over the marine resources that are up in Heckett Strait and Queen Charlotte Sound. And as far as I'm concerned, they absolutely have to be a part of any process that involves offshore oil. And 2 of them have already said they're not interested. Because, of course, their life depends a lot more on fish than does oil. It's such a fundamental part of their lifestyle that they're not willing to gamble on it. The other way that it's different is NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. NAFTA was, when it was drafted, the Atlantic Accord, which was the agreement between the Newfoundland government and the federal government, the Atlantic Accord was specifically exempted from NAFTA. And the reason it was specifically exempted is because there's a clause in NAFTA that says you cannot put any kind of performance requirements on companies that invest in Canada. It's part of Chapter 11, investment chapter. And basically, the Atlantic Accord was all about making Newfoundland hire locally. And that's why they got 5,000 jobs, because the Atlantic Accord ensured that 2/3 of the jobs that were created went to Newfoundland. Now we're living in a post-NAFTA world where there is no ability for the government to impose any kind of performance requirements, including local hiring, on offshore oil exploration or any other project for that matter. The Jakes Whitford report, which is the report that was used to give the green light for offshore oil, was released last fall. It basically said exactly that. The province has little ability to make companies hire locally. The one exemption from that, from NAFTA point of view, is that you can make companies, you can get into some sort of an agreement with the company if you pay them for some sort of a performance, like hiring locally. So in other words, if the province wants offshore oil companies to make sure that, thanks. If BC wants to ensure that there are jobs locally, they better be ready to pay companies for that privilege. Another really important difference is the technology. The Hibernia was called a gravity-based structure. It was a huge, massive structure, basically, that was so big because it was intended to withstand the impact of an iceberg. More and more what they're relying on for offshore oil explorations are floating platforms. These are less expensive, but they also create way fewer jobs. And more importantly, these platforms can be built anywhere in the world and shipped around. They're fairly expensive. They're still like $2 to $3 billion to build, and it costs nothing to move them around. So what oil and gas companies are now doing, of course, is they're building them where they're cheap, the cheapest, they have the cheapest labor, and yet still have the expertise to be able to build it. So it's not going to be built in Prince Rupert. It's not going to be built in Port Hardy. Those places don't have the expertise there. They have a deep sea port and nothing else. Where it's going to be built is it's going to be built in South Korea, where they've already built platforms, where they have the expertise there, and from the company's perspective, they have cheap labor. So it'll be built there and it'll be transported over. So the one huge economic boom that happened from a Hibernia, that 5-year construction period, we can't expect it here in BC, unless the BC government decides to use your taxpayer dollars to pay for that, to pay them to ensure that people are hired locally here. The ironic part is oil and gas companies, they haven't even been a part of this debate. They're not even interested in this because they know it's so expensive. They have their eyes set on the Northeast, on coal bed methane, on Vancouver Island. They're looking at other things because they know that offshore oil is incredibly expensive. And in fact, they're right now feeling very uncomfortable about the fact that the government's saying it's going to be this huge economic boom, because they know it's not going to be. And it puts them in a very uncomfortable position, because if offshore oil goes ahead, their corporate image will come under attack if they don't see the boom that everyone's saying there's going to be. And so in BC, you have a choice. And either way, I think it's a catch-22. If BC decides to lift the moratorium and not subsidize the project, then the projects will go ahead and the platform will be built in South Korea. There'll be very few local employment, and we'll have all the risk, all the environmental risk that exists around spills, around seismic testing, around earthquakes. All of that risk will be there, and there'll be few local jobs. The other alternative is the BC government can actually pay those companies to hire locally. And the reason that's not a good idea is because oil and gas projects don't create many jobs. So it would be an incredible loss of opportunity. On an investment basis, 60% more jobs are created in renewable energy than in oil and gas, conventional energy projects, including oil and gas. And there are five times more jobs created in conservation. And Guy talked about this. There are thousands of alternatives around renewable energy, around conservation. The reason that conservation creates so many jobs is because it's all about retrofitting. So you create all these construction jobs to retrofit buildings, and of course what ends up happening in the end is all these people who are saving energy because now their buildings are more efficient, now they have money in their pockets and they're spending it locally. So you have a huge spin-off effect from that. So the alternative for the provincial government, I think, I'll give you one, but again, there are lots, is to look seriously at renewable energy. Guy talked a lot about the economics of renewable energy. I'll give you a few more numbers just for kicks. The market for renewable energy has been expanding at a double-digit pace over the last 10 years, and it's expected to continue at that double-digit growth for the next 10 years. You look at something like at wind. 10 years ago, you were producing wind at about 20 cents a kilowatt hour. Today, it's 6 cents a kilowatt hour. In 10 years, it'll be 3 to 4. You can't get that kind of economic return on offshore oil. The profit margin is just not going to be there. 10 years from now, wind is competitive now. Wind will be blowing away oil and gas in 10 years. No pun intended. And the reason you don't see windmills everywhere right now is because the oil and gas industry is so heavily subsidized. I mean, you look at all those numbers. I mean, that's on top of the federal government alone put in $40 billion over the last 30 years to oil and gas. That's on top of, I think it was about $4 billion in subsidies to the nuclear industry. That's just the federal government. Those subsidies have come down. Now they're only subsidizing oil and gas by about $250 million a year. Last year, there was $12 million that went to renewables. That's the only reason that we're not seeing wind power being used much more than oil and gas. And it's why we're going to continue down that road towards oil and gas. What the province is what I'm scared the province does, it'll lift the moratorium, it'll say we're not subsidizing a thing. Companies come in and do exactly what they did with Hibernia's. 4 years into the project, they say, you know what, we can't do this on our own, why don't you give us some money, and they will. And we'll be further down the road of relying on oil and gas, on further enhancing climate change. What Guy talked about before in terms of the North Coast is absolutely right. The whole province has been mapped for wind energy. The two places where they say it's viable, the west coast of Vancouver Island and the North Coast. Thanks. These are both places where they need economic development. And of course, to get your biggest bang for the buck, instead of just putting up wind farms, why don't we also manufacture the turbines? Right now, Canada is so far behind the rest of the world, including Denmark, Germany, even the U.S. in this respect, and it's because we haven't put a cent into it. We haven't made any policy decisions to put these into place. So I've just been told that I'm out of time. So that's where I'll end it. Again, I encourage you to take a look at our website, policyalternatives.ca. I have, I obviously did a report on this. It's on the website. You can get it there for free. Download it, take a look at it, and let me know. I encourage feedback, even feedback like guys.